Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Welcome to the Songwriter Connection Podcast, where we look at the craft of songwriting through the eyes of the songwriter. Each week, we make a connection with a music maker, listen to their songs, and hear their stories. From Nashville, Tennessee, here's your host, Dave Letehan.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Did you ever wonder, and I didn't know the answer to this until I started working at Ryman Auditorium a few years back. I was a tour guide. It's one of the coolest jobs I ever had. Did the tour guide, and I got to work a little bit in the Make a Record department there. But did you ever hear the term French harp? Do you know what a French harp is? I didn't know until I started working at Ryman, and I did a little research. The French harp was first created in Germany in the mid-1800s, by a clockmaker. And, you know, I always wondered why a harmonica was called harp, and that's the reason why. The French harp is a harmonica, or mouth harp. So this clockmaker in Germany started making it, and it spread around Europe pretty quick. Eventually, late 1800s, it made its way to the United States, and it was a very popular instrument, especially in blues music. It was affordable, easy to learn how to play, hard to master like most instruments, but it became very famous as the French harp. And the reason is it came from Europe, and in those days, anything that came from Europe, they'd say, well, it's French, you know? So it became the French harp. And me and Bobby McGee, Chris Christopherson, went one step forward. He called it a harpoon. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. And I can't understand why you would take something out of a dirty red bandana and put it in your mouth. But that's for a whole nother show. But anyway, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the French harp today, or the harmonica. The first great harmonica player played on the Grand Ole Opry from 1921 to about around 41, so right in between the World Wars. And this guy was a wizard. In fact, they called him the harmonica wizard. His name was DeFord Bailey. And DeFord Bailey was one of the most popular performers on the Grand Ole Opry at that time. He was a sickly boy when he was growing up, and he had a mouth harp, and he would play it, and he got very good at it. He would start to make it sound like the chickens pecking in the yard, or a freight train passing by. And by the time he got to the Opry, he had a song called the Pan American Blues, where you could just about picture that train approaching and passing by. This is DeFord Bailey right here. Can you hear it? Oh, yeah. And they'd go crazy for him. They really did. Amazing, amazing performer. The French harp, he was just awesome at it. Now, the thing about DeFord Bailey is, when he played the Grand Ole Opry, and you couldn't see him because it was radio, right? But when he hit that stage, he was dressed to the nines. He'd have the suit, the tie, and he'd get out there and he'd play, and he'd knock him dead. But when the Opry started touring to different areas around the country, especially in the South, people were shocked because DeFord Bailey was a black man, and they didn't know it because they heard him on the radio. Some of the hotels that he stayed in, all of them in the South, he wasn't allowed to stay in the same hotels as the Opry stars that were playing that night. And there was a big star at the time by the name of Uncle Dave Macon, who was not having any of that. And he used to tell him, hey, he is with me. He's my personal vet. If he doesn't stay, we don't stay. So it was a very interesting time. He was an amazing star. I got a chance to meet his grandson a few years back, and we had a long talk about DeFord Bailey. So I wanted to give you a little bit on the harp today. Play a little bit of today's harp music. Playing that harp is our guest on the show today. Live in Spain, it's the Reverend Amos, Sean Amos, back with his band, The Brotherhood. And Sean is our guest. I got him on the phone. Sean, how are you today? Good to have you here.
I'm doing great, man. I love the history lesson. Thank you.
Well, I'm all about the history, my friend. I really am, you know. You've got a new album. And let me just tell folks a little bit about you. Award-winning author, Cookies and Milk, and was followed up by Ellis Johnson, Might Be Famous. You are a Grammy-nominated producer, podcaster. I love your podcast called The Cause of It All. Check it out if you haven't heard it. And the son of Wally, Famous Amos, the cookie guy, and a singer, Cheryl E. Ellis. So music is in your blood, isn't it, Sean?
You know, I'm destined or doomed, depending on who you ask.
Oh, you love it. It's one of the things that you do. and a master on that harmonica as well. And you've got a brand new album coming out. Well, it is out now. May 3rd was released. And it's called Soul Brother Number 1. And I've been listening to this. Sean, I got to tell you, I love the sound of this record.
Oh, thank you, man.
Man, we're going to get deep into it, and we're going to play some of the songs from this record. But the last few years since COVID, Sean, has really been years of self-discovery for you, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, everybody, right? I hope I'm not the only one. I mean, how could we not? You know, we're all trapped inside, you know, looking at ourselves all day long. How could you not look for some clues?
I always talk about folks, you know, especially for songwriters, the songwriter side is that you evolve in your craft. Yeah, and you do. There's no way around it. We grow and we evolve, right?
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. Yeah.
if you're lucky and if you're listening, let's keep listening for clues. But COVID and sort of the years afterwards have been big for me. I mean, I was on these roads anyway. I just had some time to, you know, travel more deeply than I had in the years previously.
Yeah, and been all over, like Spain that we just heard. So big on Roots Radio. I make no bones about this. My favorite radio station here in Nashville is Roots Radio WMOT, and I've heard you on that many times. Yeah,
they've been so good to me, man. They've been so good to me. They're good people over there.
Love the interview with Jesse Scott.
Jesse is a queen.
Isn't she something else? Absolutely love her. And saw some videos of you at the 30A Festival. Great, great stuff. Yeah.
I love it down there. Yeah. In a world of festival saturation, festival overload, that one holds on to its charm.
I love doing the festivals. You get people and you meet people, you know, and other artists and sometimes make connections that will last forever. So,
yeah, there's a degree of camaraderie that surfaces up there.
Absolutely. Well, tell us how your music has evolved in this journey for you of self-discovery in the last few years.
Oh man, how much time do we have?
We can break this into 10 different podcasts.
Yeah, right? I mean, totally. I mean, look, I think the title of the record sort of says it. You know, the Soul Brother Number 1, which is both a nod towards soul albums of the 70s. Right. It's an aspirational title, and it speaks to a sort of sense of Black pride, I guess, and that's been a lot of what I've been about. You know, I think the book I wrote, the first book I wrote, Cookies and Milk, which was a semi autobiographical story of my childhood and growing up with my dad and helping him start to open up this first cookie store.
Yeah.
My parents were divorced and, you know, that book, I wrote it. And then when I was writing it, it was clearly a cathartic experience. And I was clearly revisiting a lot of old turf, but I underestimated sort of all the subconscious, rattling it did in me. And it sort of set me in this 70s time. It did a couple of things. One, it sort of got me really in love with the 70s again. And so I wanted to sort of explore that musical terrain a bit more than I have before. And it got me thinking about my identity and sort of, and how I see myself and how we see each other and how we get along and how we choose not to get along with each other. And so I want to explore those, that musical terrain and those themes a lot more head on than I have in the past.
I've heard it said that it was that book, Cookies and Milk, was kind of a bridge between you and your son's relationship and you and your father, huh? Because
I wrote that in the foreword.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my father's got dementia now. And so, getting any clues out of him, that's over. Mm. And my son's at an age like most, kids were. Yeah, they don't even give a shit about where he came from. Yeah, and so I'm trying to you know, connect the dots and leave some clues. And I thought I was leaving them mainly for my son, but I'm definitely leaving them, you know, for me as well.
It's a great book, and it's an award-winning book. What was it like in the 70s? Your dad in the cookies and in the fame. How did that affect you growing up?
You know, in some sense, I mean, look, I grew up in Hollywood, California. Mm-hmm. I grew up in around show business. My father was a talent agent at William Morris Agency. He booked the Simon and Garfunkel. He booked a lot of the Motown acts. He booked the Animals.
Wow.
The first American tour. And then he became a talent manager. My mom was a nightclub singer. So, yeah, I mean, most of the people I knew growing up were in entertainment. You know, they were either performers or they were, you know, working behind the scenes. And so that world was, there was nothing really glamorous about that world to me. It's what people did.
You know, and you were no stranger to it. You grew up around it, and it was just a part of your life, huh?
Grew up on movie sets and nightclubs and recording studios, and that was just what people did. And the work of it, I would say, the work of it is so unglamorous. Mm. I mean, the only glamorous part is when you get up on stage and when you know, go to a movie premiere.
That's right.
But the actual making of this stuff is pretty damn arduous and, you know, boring at times.
And long days.
Long days. You just grind it out. You do the work. And so it gave me a real work ethic, if nothing else. It really wasn't any kind of sense of being famous or wanting to, you know, have people know my name. My father always said, you know, being famous just means, you know, a lot of people know who you are. It doesn't really tell much, not good for much else. But,
is that the reason for the follow-up book? Ellis Johnson, Maybe Famous?
Might be famous. The follow-up was, I mean, on a product level, it was a two-book deal, and I had to write a second book. there's the unsexy answer.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, like, it allowed me to go deeper into this idea of blended family. I mean, look, I'm a divorced father. I've repeated a lot of the mistakes of my father. There's a lot of this wanting to figure out, you know, how we break family cycles, because we all seem to sort of fall into them in various ways.
Yeah.
And so it was a chance for me to sort of explore the notion of, you know, the effect divorce has, the effect, you know, the blended families have. And the difference between falling in love with mastery of something versus falling in love with being famous at doing something. Mm. And I think we live in an age right now where we're much more, many of us are much more enamored with being famous than we are with actually mastering.
100%. I agree. 100%. That's the world we're living in, unfortunately. Yeah.
I went to film school in NYU. I remember a great professor I had said, you know, fall in love with the work because the work is all you got. And so I've always held that, man. You know, it's like you got to love the work. The work has to be enough. And if other stuff comes from it, great. But the work has to be enough.
Sean, I love that. I got to teach for a little while in broadcasting, and I used to tell my students, you better have a passion for it, and if you don't, maybe you're not looking in the right place for a future career.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same with music. You have a passion. You know, my friend Mark Allen Barnett's been on the show a million times. He says, you know, music doesn't, you don't choose music. Music chooses you, was his line.
Yeah, for sure. And I've got to do it. Different times to, you know,
absolutely
walk away from the goddamn thing. But
it always pulls you back.
He's got too strong a hold, man.
Yeah, it always pulls you right back. Well, let's talk about this new project, which is kind of different for you, isn't it? One of the things I read was you wanted to take more, and to me, this is what it means. You said you wanted more of an Elton John, Bernie Taupin kind of approach. So you're talking co-writing, friend, right? Like we do here in Nashville, right?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, uh-huh. I mean, I've come to, and this probably was now growth of the book as well. I mean, above all else, I'm a lyricist. You know, I've got a limited, you know, compositional abilities enough to write some pretty good blues songs, and some, you know, good, you know, sort of folk, you know, songs, Americana songs. But, you know, as I was getting into wanting to have a soul influence on this album, you know, that's still, I just realized the sort of voicings. One, I want a lot of them to be piano based or keyboard based songs, and I don't play keys or piano, the voicings that I was hearing in my head, I just could not bring into reality. And so I needed to, I knew the stories I wanted to tell. I knew the musical landscape. I could hear it, but I couldn't get it out on my own. And so I needed to collaborate with composers. And so, it was great. It was a great, and I hinted at that. Yeah, I've done a bit of that with my longtime guitarist, Dr. Roberts, where during COVID, he would send me pieces of music he'd written. I'd write songs to it. And it's such a gift. You know, it was just so nice to only have to focus on lyrics and sort of double down on what I think is, you know, one of the things I do best is write lyrics and write words. And so I sort of took that experience with the doctor further and explored some collaborations with other musicians. And it was just super, super, super rewarding.
And we talk a lot about co-writing because that's what we do in Nashville. And I really encourage folks to co-write because just what you said, everybody's got their own different strengths. And so you know where your strength is. But you know what? When you're doing this process of co-writing, I don't know about you, but I always take something from the people I'm co-writing with. I learned as
oh
I
oh, my
do
God.
It, right?
Yeah. Well, it gets you out of bad habits. We all fall into these just sort of, you know, patterns and kind of, you know, musical ruts. You know, we have a bag of tricks. And and it's good to you know, step into the deep end of the pool a little bit and get a little bit out of your depth and shake things up and hear things differently and phrase things differently. And absolutely, it makes you a better writer.
It surely does. Well, let's play something from the record. How about, can we play Soul Brother Number One? We'll start with the title cut.
Please, go for it.
Tell us a little bit about the writing of that song and what it's all about.
This is the first song I wrote. I mean, I knew I had an album called Soul Brother Number One. I knew this is the first song. I have a voice memo on my iPhone where I sort of sang a good chunk of the song a cappella.
Yeah.
Opened up GarageBand and wrote this really lame horn part that Dapo Toramira, who's my co-writer, turned into a much better horn part. and so it all began with this song.
Number one, soul brother. Hey.
What a great song, Sean. Awesome, man. Love it. That is the title cut of the new record, Soul Brother Number One, from the Reverend Sean Amos, our guest on the Songwriter Connection podcast. Sonically, this album is amazing. You had a great producer, didn't you?
Yeah, I've worked with James Sayas for my last, three, four albums now. Just a wonder. We met. He does a lot of film and TV work as well. And we met because I did a harmonica part for, I think it's an AMC show called Preacher, the Seth Rogen produced show. And he needed a harmonica part for the main title. And we were introduced to a mutual friend. And I just loved his attention to detail. There's something about working with someone who, making an album with someone who also works in film and TV. One, there's just a speed because you have to move really fast in film and TV. And there's an exactness that's required of film and TV. And so his skills, not only as a producer, but as an engineer, and being able to, you know, pick up a guitar and figure out a voicing really fast. He's just sort of this, like, you know, Swiss Army knife of a guy.
That's awesome.
And so I love working with him because he can just, you know, sort of keep up with, you know, the pace in my brain, and he pushes me in different directions.
He also produced, was it Social D, Social Distraction?
I worked with Porno for Pyros. In his early days, he was a second engineer on a bunch of print stuff over at Sound City.
Interesting.
Yeah, and he's a great dude. And so he produced I did one track on my own, the song Back to the Beginning, which is the one song we recorded in Nashville with the McCreary Sisters. I produced that myself. It's the first time I've produced myself in a long time.
But I think we're going to play that next, and we're going to talk about that.
Oh, great. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And the other thing is, too, you know, James has so many great players. I mean, he introduced me to Dapo Toromiro, who's a Nigerian player who I ended up co-writing with. He introduced me to Steve Ferroni, who played drums on the thing.
Yeah. And you know, this is an all-star band that he put together.
Tell us
more about it, because you had people that played with Tom Petty and, it's just average white band. These players are absolutely amazing, aren't they?
I've been really lucky that all my albums have had just really amazing players. I think it's partly I'm blessed that they see something in my songs and believe what I'm doing. Part of it is me having a lot of relationships and, you know, living where I've lived for so many years. But I've been really lucky. And so with this album, I wanted someone who came from just a funky soul, you know, background. It could just hit a pocket and everyone associates Steve with his long tenure with Tom Petty and Heartbreakers, deservedly so. But, you know, he was an average white band. I mean, he's played on Chaka Khan hits. I mean, you know, he's like a pocket, you know, funky drummer. And so I brought his name up to James, and James tracked him down and talked him into it for me. And then on bass is Jerry Say, who also goes by the name Wizard. Most people know him as there's a great band out of Atlanta in the late 70s called Mother's Finest.
Yes.
That was just this legendary sort of funk rock band. And they're still together. They're still touring. And Wizard's the bass player from Mother's Finest. And he and I met on a blues cruise, on one of Joe Bonamassa's blues cruises. He was playing with Keb Moe.
Awesome.
I called him up and asked if he'd do it. I was a little nervous, and he said yes. It's just, you know, people does the songs, they have the vision for the record, and also musicians want to play, man. You always think the tendency is, oh my God, they'll never play for me. Oh my God, they play with Tom Petty, they play with whoever, and you know, musicians want to play.
Yeah, they do.
And they'd rather be in a studio than sit around at home. Unless there's a conflict or someone's got some, you know, exorbitant, you know, sense of himself financially. It's easier than you think to get the players you want.
How about that? Never be afraid to ask. The answer's always no until you ask, right?
That is it, baby. That is it.
You know what I love about this album? It's really different from a lot of your previous stuff. I mean, you were pretty much straight blues, now you're bringing in funk music, like you said, that sound of the 70s, which I absolutely loved. And there are times, I'm telling you, sonically, this thing, I hear everything from, like you say, average white band, sometimes Steely Dan, I'm hearing.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? And, you know, even do a Sly and the Family Stone cover.
Sly was a big influence, you know. His sort of spirit was hanging over the whole thing. And I used to perform that song. So we covered Don't Call Me Nigger Whitey, which is sort of an odd cover.
Yeah.
But I used to actually play that live years ago.
Did you?
I think it's really sort of a brilliant, it's like an inverse come together song. I mean, because what's really saying is, hey, you know, we're all the same. Can we all just, you know, get along?
And
obviously, you know, the N word is what pops out there, but, you know, exactly. The whitey, which sounds less disparaging, is also, so it's like, you know, everyone just wants to be seen for who they are, you know,
right.
black, white, otherwise, they just want to be seen for who they are. And I think the song says that in its own sort of, irreverent, sort of in your face way.
You know, another song that really hit me hard on your record, and again, lyrically, I mean, the sound is great too, but lyrically, talk about if I could just go back, you know, if I could go back and see me and change
back
things.
To the beginning.
Yeah, and back to the beginning, you know, think about that and tell us how that one came about.
And that one, yeah, it's funny. It grew out of meditation.
Actually. Did it really? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big meditator, and it grew out of this idea of like, you know, they call it the beginner's mind, right? And if you can just sort of, you have a beginner's mind with things and approach things as if you're, you know, a child. I wrote a song years ago. I don't think I ever released it even, called "Come to You, a Child," which is the idea of like, you know, if we come to, you know, each other just with this sort of like childlike mind with no preconceptions.
Right.
And that was really about other people seeing you, but I was like, well, how we see ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's a bit of just permission to start again. You know, I mean, that's just one of the first things you learn in meditation, which is, you know, begin again. Your mind gets distracted, begin again. You know, you have a bad day and you lose your temper, begin again.
We can always begin again.
Right. You know, you say you're on a diet, you slip up eating something, begin again. You can always begin again.
Absolutely.
And so that's just a little hymn and a little reminder to begin again. And the McCrary sisters were the first and only choice to sing on it. And it's the one song we recorded, you know, and mixed. We mixed some of the album in Nashville, but other tracks in Nashville. But it's the one song that was fully recorded and mixed in Nashville. And I want everything that the rest of the album that we talked about, this sort of like funk and this pocket and this sort of the exactitude, you know, this one just felt more back porch and a little looser. And I just wanted, you know, a little bit of that Nashville stank on it.
And of course, the McCrary sisters being from Nashville, three of them now, we lost Deborah a couple of years ago, but they just add something to this track. They also, in the past, we've had a band called the Flat River Band who was on this podcast, and the McCrary sisters backed them up on a song. So I've been in love with them. So this is just, it's amazing. Let's play it right now. This is Back to the Beginning. Reverend Sean Amos is our guest on the Songwriter Connection. Thanks for joining us.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
You're listening to The Songwriter Connection, connecting with music makers and hearing their songs and stories. Now back to the show with your host, Dave Linehan.
Back with Reverend Sean Amos, our guest on the Songwriter Connection podcast, playing tracks from and digging into the new album, which is called Soul Brother Number One. Sean, thanks again for joining us. We just listened to, before the break, Back to the Beginning, which is a really cool song. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That one's got a little bit of a different vibe. It breathes a little bit differently than the other ones.
I am curious to Reverend. So are you a minister as well?
I'm a reverend in the Church of the Blues, but
Church of the Blues,
that's my church and my blues congregation who I preach to. God, I was given the name Reverend by a room full of Italians. The first time I ever played the blues, I told the story before, but I was invited to go play blues in Italy in 2010, 2011, and by an old bandmate of mine. And up until that point, I'd been a student of the blues and just loved it as a listener, but never played it. And so he knew that my knowledge was deep. And like, hey, come on over. I got this gig playing blues for a couple weeks in Italy. Pick whatever song list you want of all your favorite blues songs. So I went over there, did it, and everything I sort of thought about performing the blues, I thought it'd be this sort of like downtrodden, emotional sort of thing, was completely opposite. And what came out of me as I channeled this music was nothing but pure joy. I mean, in my harmonica case to this day, when I put up my harmonica case on stage, the word joy is inside my harmonica case for the audience to see. And I call what I play joyful blues. And I discovered that the joy in this music in real time, singing these songs on stage in Italy, and I became a really different performer than the performer I was when I was doing sort of the acoustic Americana shoegazer, super sensitive, acoustic thing. And so, so by the end of the show, the audience was chanting, El Reverendo, El Reverendo. And I'm like, what is that? They're calling you the Reverend. I'm like, a bunch of Italian Catholics are going to call me the Reverend. I must adhere. So I came back to the stage, held on to the moniker, and I thought, okay, well, after a few gigs playing here, I'm like, well, if I'm calling myself the Reverend, I better really be a Reverend. So through the magic of the internet and Universal Life Church, home to Conan O'Brien's Reverendhood and some others, I became a Reverend. So I preach on stage, and I've officiated some weddings for some dear friends. And,
very cool. I was going to ask about weddings.
I got a little bit of power.
You got the power.
Yeah.
As Penny Ford used to say, I got the power.
Amen.
I got to meet her a while back in Cincinnati.
Really?
She was dating a really good friend.
Oh, man.
Wonderful lady. Yeah.
Yeah, she's character.
Yeah. Hey, tell us about some of the music you were listening to growing up. I know your dad was representing Simon and Garfunkel, things like that. But just tell us about some of the music that you grew up on.
I mean, like most people my age, right? I mean, I got brought into it through, I sort of like the second wave of 60s bands. I wasn't old enough to experience that stuff firsthand, but the momentum of that stuff was still going strong. So, the Beatles and the Who, the Stones and all that kind of stuff. And then I got really deep into singer-songwriters, Joan Armatrading. I was really into female singer-songwriters. Joni Mitchell, Joan Armatrading, Carole King. I was a sensitive, asthmatic, kid living in LA. And so I liked a lot of this sort of confessional, but that's where my love of lyrics happened. I mean, and then Paul Simon, and then Elvis Costello, and then I got deeper into Bob Dylan. But I would say the first you know, 10, 15 years of my music listening life, it was all about lyrics. I mean, I didn't really care about melody. I was just reading lyrics and really learning how people were constructing songs. I was a huge Pete Townsend fan, and I still am. I love just spiritual and sort of these big ideas. Just, you know, the idea that you could fit such big, big, big ideas into a 3-minute song just astounded me.
Isn't it something how that's done?
Just the physics of it. The physics of it. How can you, and Paul Simon. And so that was really, you know, that's what I cut my teeth on. It was just, you know, really dissecting lyrics of all these great singer-songwriters. First concert I went to, my father took me to see Elton John at Dodger Stadium.
No.
The famous show where he wore the glitter, you know, Dodger. Oh. Yeah, the Dodger. Yeah. So
you were at that show. Ever. Oh, my God.
I was at that show with my dad.
Jealous.
Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Saw the Stones in 81 at the Tattoo U tour where they were Prince open and they booed him off stage and Bill Graham berated the audience. It was just, you know, that was sort of it. And then, you know, later, you know, I realized that most of those artists were either, you know, borrowing or paying homage or stealing from, you know, black musicians.
Yeah.
And then I got into black music and soul music and blues and sort of went deep in there and sort of connected the dots back. And that's sort of my personal journey as well. It's like, you know, so much of my identity was formed by, you know, white musicians copying black music.
Well, I've read that, you know, you grew up, a lot of your friends were white and
all of them were. Only black kid. In the book, you know, Ellis Johnson, the kid in my book, he's the only black kid in the school and black kid in his neighborhood. And that was my life. And so there's no one who looked like me, to see. And the people I was listening to, cause I genuinely, you know, dug them. But I also was trying to fit in, you know, trying to take a path of least resistance. So the discovery of black music and, you know, was sort of, you know, a way for me to get back to, you know, who I was and learn about myself and sort of in the absence of having any folks around me who could tell me a lot of stuff. I learned about my people and my history and my past, you know, through R&B records and through soul.
Getting to your roots. I've heard you say that you really threw yourself out there with this record, that you've sung like you've never before did, and you never wrote like this before. You're firing on all cylinders, and with all your joy and your rage and your hubris, and I think all of these things, these emotions go into great songs and great productions. So it's really been kind of a revelation for you, to quote a song from your album.
Oh, what a setup, what a setup.
I'm the king of segues, my friend. Got it from our radio days. Anyway, I'm sorry. Yeah, so it's been a revelation, huh?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It's been this awakening, you know, and learning to be unapologetic. I mean, it's unapologetically black, unapologetically me, and sort of not being concerned with how that's going to be received.
Yeah, I got it.
I was listening to I was listening to another podcast the other day. I can't remember what it was by the time, but it was Malcolm McDowell, the actor, talking about John Lennon. First time he saw John Lennon play, and now it's just like, you know, he was unmistakably just saying, "Fuck you! I don't care what you think. I don't care if you like it or not. Fuck you!" Yeah. And that's kind of where I'm arriving at.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've got to hear that podcast, by the way. Now I'm jotting this down right now because I'm going to find that one and listen.
He was being interviewed by Mark Maron's podcast.
Okay, I'm going to find that one for sure. Yeah. On Revelation, I have to tell you, one of the cool, and I want people to go to your website. Tell them about your website real quick.
SeanAmos.com, SeanAmos.com.
All kinds of great information there and some videos. In fact, there is a great video where you take everybody into the studio with you for Revelation, huh?
Yeah.
That's cool. I like it.
Thank you.
So you can see all the band there performing and you singing as well. So I encourage you to do that. But I'm going to play it for you right now. This is Revelation from Soul Brother Number One.
I predict we all gonna stay here together. We'll be right back.
Great song there, Revelation, which is that's the first song on the album, isn't it, Sean?
That is the opening cut, and it's the first single we put out, and it's actually a song written with the Brotherhood.
With the Brotherhood
during COVID,
the band,
with my band, the Brotherhood, Brady Blade, Christopher Thomas, and Dr. Roberts. We during COVID, we were doing some co-writing together. We were all cooped up in our different locations. I was in Texas, and Dr. in Los Angeles. Brady lives in Stockholm. CT in Paris, and so we would send tracks back and forth to each other, and we wrote a fair number of songs through that process, and Revelation is one of them.
That's cool. Yeah, during COVID, we learned to do things a lot differently. Thank God for
Zoom. Yeah, man, yeah. Totally. I mean, that was sort of the beginning of, like I said earlier, it's like I would get these tracks, like the doctor, there's like this musical game of hot potato where doctor would write a guitar riff, he'd pass it over to TT and he'd lay a bass thing to it, and he'd pass it over to Brady and he'd lay a drum track, and I'd get this, basically a demo, without any lyrics on it. And it was it was a luxury. I'm like, oh my God, I get this like finished song that I can just, spend my time and walk around my place and just, think of lyrics too. It was kind of a nice little gift I'd get in my inbox every now and then. And then we would do these sort of quarantine jams, we called them, and play together virtually. And there's a bunch of them on my YouTube channel. They're quite fun, actually.
That process that you talk about, you get a track in and then write to that track. We call that top-down writing. And it's a challenge in itself, isn't it? It's a challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge, yeah. And every now and then I would sort of make a comment back. I'm like, hey, can you take a couple bars out of this section here? Mm-hmm, can you move? Can you move the bridge up? Because I want to go to the bridge a little bit earlier. So I'd make a few little sort of arrangement comments like that to help the lyrics sit a bit better for me. But I loved it. I loved the process. I just walk around with my headphones on and just spend time with this thing, and just it's like a it's like painting. You sort of see this canvas and there's something on there, and you sort of
Oh, yeah.
Imagine how you can see it unfold. I really love that process a lot.
I love that analogy. I really do. I'm a big jazz music fan, too. So, I mean, you listen to a track and you just get the mood and the feel for it, you know, that prosody and where it's going. And yeah, and then I get these. A lot of times when I'm in a writing session, I've got to hear the melody. Let me hear that melody. Play that melody again, and I'll tell them. And they look at me like, well, I'm working on the words. But, you know, sometimes if you listen to the melody, those words will pop out. And that's why I like to have my guitar with me. And sometimes I'm playing the chords. And sometimes it just pops out because you're in that mood. You're in that creative space, you know. Does that happen to you?
I mean, I see myself as the melody, you know. So I, you know, particularly with you know, there's licks, you know, they're often being delivered to me.
Yeah.
And there's certainly a rhythm and a bass line melody, but you need a top line melody. I mean, you gotta, and so I see myself as the melody. So I'm always looking for, you know, how can I find counterpoint in what I'm hearing? You know, what is the line that's going to sit on top of all this and make it sing literally, but figuratively as well.
I love that. I think there's the title of our podcast. I see myself as the melody. I love that. Yeah. That is fantastic. And we're talking about top downwriting, which was kind of just the opposite. We talked about Bernie Taupin and Elton John earlier. It was just the opposite, right? I mean, Bernie would give him all these lyrics, and then he'd have to develop the melody.
I mean, he's writing poetry, basically.
Elton's
putting us up to poetry. I mean, I've done a fair amount of that as well. I mean, I definitely have.
Have you?
I mean, I have tons and tons of lyrics that are sitting around that you're all looking for music for him. But I like it both ways. You know, I mean, there's oftentimes and every now and then, once in a blue moon, it'll all come together for me. But the key is to be unattached to any one particular process or any one outcome. Yeah, you really need to. I just need to. You grab it wherever it comes. If it's a line, grab it. If it's a few bars of a cool groove or a rhythm melody, grab it. If it's a verse, I mean, just grab it if you can grab it. I mean, don't ignore any of it. The worst mistakes I ever made writing were thinking, you know, I would remember it later, or sort of dismissing it as not being enough of something.
These are things you learn from experience, right? And we evolve, as we talked about, huh? Yeah.
But grab everything. Pay attention to everything.
There's a reason why it entered your mind, right?
Don't discount any of it.
Do not. You've got a new video out, relatively new, and it's kind of an animated thing. Starts with all that LA traffic, and I really love it. It's all going to change for the better, which is such a positive message that we need today, right?
It's a double entendre. The song was musically is inspired by Johnny Guitar Watson.
Yeah.
Real big musical hero of mine. So I was trying to actually sing a little bit like him. I double tracked my vocal, which I rarely do, to get sort of, you know, Johnny Guitar Watson vibe.
Oh, that's
But story wise, there's two songs. The song that closes the album is called Things Will Be Fine.
Yeah.
And this song is almost like a counterpoint to that song. They almost have similar titles, right? It's all going to change for the better. Things will be fine. But both of them have this sort of caveat, which is, it's all going to change for the better and things will be fine, but only if we do the work. it won't happen just because it's going to happen. We're going to have to actually put some elbow grease into it.
Oh, and yes, so, we do. Yes.
The idea behind It's All Going to Change for the Better is, you know, we're on the precipice of a lot of horrible shit happening. And one might say, it's always changed for the better. How can you even look around and even think that? Mm-hmm. But it's always changed for the better for somebody. You know, either the plant's going to be here without us and the planet will be fine. Like, to quote that George Carlin great line.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, it's the people, stupid. The planet will be fine. Yeah, the people
and
are fine.
Cockroaches will survive.
So there's that end of it. Or it's like, hey, it's always changed for the better for all of us if we can, you know, come together, right? and drop our shit and get past ourselves. So, it's a little bit of, you know, tough love.
That's awesome. Folks, I want you to listen to the record. It's Soul Brother Number One, and it's from the Reverend Sean Amos, and we're going to play this song right now. It's All Going to Change for the Better, and be around the other side to wrap things up. Reverend Sean Amos is with us on the Songwriter Connection. Sean, I've enjoyed our conversation. So nice to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, brother. I love talking about songs. So many of these podcasts, you're talking about everything but songwriting. it's great to talk about the craft. I appreciate it.
I love to talk about the craft, and I appreciate the insights you've given us and the process that you use, because we learn from this. We really do. I want folks to pick up your record. It's available everywhere, and it's streaming everywhere. So wherever you steal music, you could find it. But I really like to get a copy of it. I really do.
Please do. Yeah.
Is it available in vinyl? Let me ask you that. I'm a vinyl.
Not drinker. Yet. No, not yet? No, I've done vinyl yet. Yeah. It's okay. One, because it's such a backlog. Two, I'm taking a page from Billie Eilish's command and trying to do away with a little more environmentally friendly.
I got you. One last question on Things Will Be Fine, and I want you to listen to that. It's kind of the follow up to the song that we just played. But you've got you featured an amazing voice with you there. Who is that, the lady?
Oh, my God. Yeah. Denise Caridi, who actually lives in Nashville. And she's done some work with Coldplay, and she's just phenomenal. And she's all over the record. I she came in for one song. I loved her voice so much. I loved singing with her so much that I ended up, like, I think it's like three or four tracks.
That's awesome.
In some capacity or another. And the album's called Soul Brother Number One, but there need to be some Soul Sisters on there. So.
Yeah, there has to be. Absolutely.
She's Soul Sister Number One.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
I love it.
I appreciate it. It was good to talk to you. And hopefully we can connect when you get to Nashville, back to Nashville. I know you come back probably in September for the Americana Fest, right?
Definitely be there for Americana. Yeah, I'll definitely be there for that.
Maybe we can get you on the show here live and in person. So that'd be awesome.
Would love it. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Songwriter Connection podcast. Find us on social media at Songwriter Connection. Also, listen to Dave Lanahan's Nashville Connections radio show. It streams live every Friday morning on WOBL and WNOI. Look for us on Facebook and YouTube. See you next time on Songwriter Connection.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.